Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Machon Hadar. For those of you who I don't know, or who don't know me, I'm Shai Held. I'm president and dean of Machon Hadar. I want to just take a minute to say something about this series and what we're about to do. This series is an experiment in something new for us, about trying to marry... You want me to use this?
Yeah,
for this?
Okay,
this is
great.
Fabulous. This always makes me feel like I'm supposed to sing.
Go for it.
For your sake, you want to retract that invitation. I'm tempted to tell you about how my five-year-old this afternoon told me that she can now sing Scarborough Fair, and what followed was interesting. So this series is new and an experiment for us. In that we're really trying to bring together two of the things we've done in evening programs together, which is serious learning of text and serious conversation about contemporary issues. And the series emerged out of a sense that this is a moment when we are or ought to be extremely mindful of and attentive to the questions of who are the people who in our society who are currently most vulnerable and exposed. And what are our responsibilities as Jews, as human beings, as political citizens? How do those categories overlap, not overlap, in terms of responding to the needs of those in society who are, in fact, most defenseless and vulnerable? We chose to enact this series, to put together the series, because we thought that Hadar's contribution to this conversation and this political moment ought to be about what Hadar does, which is to try and deepen the lens of Torah that we as Jews can apply to the questions that are burning in this moment. And that's what the aspiration of this series is. Each of these 3 weeks will be a shiur presentation followed by a discussion. This week, I will talk about the ger, the stranger. I'll talk about that term in a minute, and then be in conversation with Rabbi Jenny Rosen from Hyas, who I'll introduce a little later. Next week, Rabbi Avi Killip will speak about Jewish legal conceptions of the ways in which widows are at once vulnerable and powerful, and then be in conversation with Ruth Messenger about empowering women throughout the world. And in our third week, Rabbi Jason Rubenstein will speak about orphans in the history of Jewish law, and then engage in a very personal conversation with Tamar Fox, one of our alums, about the project of foster parenting and the role of foster parenting in America in general. So I hope you'll join us for any or all of those. So tonight, as I said, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ger, this biblical category, which I'll explain, after which Rabbi Rosen and I will talk about the global refugee crisis and what a Jewish response to it could and should perhaps look like. The topic of the ger, I'm going to translate that word in just a minute, is, I would say, one of the great moral challenges that the Torah introduces to the world, and it is really one of the great moral revolutions of the Torah, and how exactly it's a revolution, I will get to a little bit later. I want to start by thinking about the moral challenge, and then later we'll talk about the ways in which it's not just a moral challenge, but in fact it's an unprecedented moral revolution at the moment when the Bible emerges in the world. But in order to do that, let me just spend a minute talking about the word ger. If you were raised in a traditional Jewish setting, you know that most likely your first association, your primary association with the word ger is convert, right? That is rabbinic Hebrew, okay? One of the great challenges for anyone who studies Jewish texts is the assumption that because I know a later version of Hebrew, I know earlier Hebrew. I always say, like, one of the great challenges of learning Tanakh is knowing modern Hebrew first. Because all these things you think you understand that you, in fact, don't. Because you assume that modern Hebrew meanings are what's meant there. The sages knew very well that in the Bible, a ger is not a convert. After all, the Bible says repeatedly, ki gerim hi yitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, because you were gerim in the land of Egypt, which clearly does not mean, as they knew full well, that the Israelites had been converts to Egyptian religion in Egypt. They knew that. Why they choose to kind of evolve the meaning of that word and how that happens is its own discussion. But ger in the Bible is a word that people have always struggled to translate. In most contemporary academic translations, you find the word stranger, which I will say I have found in teaching about this category for many years in America is hugely problematic because people can't overcome their sense that a stranger is someone I haven't met yet, which is not what stranger means to convey when we're talking about gerim. More useful is the King James translation that is still in play in certain settings, which is a sojourner, right? Meaning someone who is currently dwelling among you, but is not of you in some fundamental way. More recently, some scholars have suggested that the word stranger and sojourner are both problematic as translations of the word ger because they focus exclusively on the present status of the ger. What is his or her situation in the society in which he or she finds themselves, but do not take into account what is equally important, which is the past of the ger that brought him or her into the situation in the first place, right? That ger is not, they suggest, just a description of the political situation of this person, but also of what was it about their place of origin that led them to now be here in this vulnerable position. That has led some scholars, most influentially a man named Frank Spina, who teaches at a Christian seminary in Seattle, to argue that a much better translation of ger is actually immigrant, someone who has come from someplace else and is now living among you. Okay, and we'll see that as we go. Okay. So first, biblical verses. Okay. What I want to try to do, just to sort of give you a sense of where I'm going with this, I want to sort of just show first this fascinating development in the Bible from Exodus to Leviticus to Deuteronomy, from Shemot to Vayikra to Devarim, in what I'll call a kind of increasing radicalization of Jewish responsibility, Israelite responsibility for this ger, immigrant, stranger. I'm going to use those terms interchangeably and hope you'll bear with me. Okay? So Exodus 23, we're in the middle of Parashat Mishpatim, one of the Torah's three central law codes, and it says the following: V'ger lo tilchatz, you shall not oppress a stranger, v'atem yedatem et nefesh hager, because you know the life experience of the ger, you know what it's like to be a ger, kigerim yitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, because you yourselves were gerim, were strangers, sojourners in the land of Egypt. So here, the appeal is, right, to your experience, which should open you to the possibility of empathy. Now, I want to be clear about something, because I think people often misstate this. At least, I want to suggest they do. I don't for one second think that the Torah believes that the obligation not to oppress immigrants derives from Israel's suffering in Egypt. As if you could raise your hand and say, well, I was not a stranger in Egypt, therefore I have no obligation to the stranger. Right? That makes no moral or conceptual sense. Rather, I think what Exodus is saying is your historical experience ought to amplify your understanding of and commitment to living up to this fundamental moral obligation not to oppress the weak in general, and this category of weak people in particular. That's an important distinction. I just don't think the Torah believes that the obligation derives from being a stranger, right? It is intensified, amplified, if you will, by that. By, again, you know what it feels like. Leviticus, Vayikra, goes one dramatic step further. So Leviticus 19, right? V'chi yagur yitcha ger ba'artzichem lo tonu oto. When a stranger lives with you in your land, you shall not oppress him. Right? So that begins as essentially a reiteration of Exodus, right? Same principle, a negative commandment, prohibition, mitzvat lo taseh, whatever language works for you. But then Leviticus goes on. Ka'ezrach mikem yiyeh lachem hager hagar itchem. Now here, I am not convinced by the JPS translation. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. That feels to me like it's modern Hebrew. I am not sure ezrach means citizen in biblical Hebrew. I think ezrach means something like native born, someone who is one of your kin group. Not sure it has political valence yet, the way it does in modern Hebrew. Okay? So the person should be to you as one of your native born, even though the person is not kin, and therefore not part of the in-group. Nevertheless, you should see them treat them as one of you. And then this totally radical statement, Ve'avta lo kamocha, and you should love him as yourself. Why? Ki geirim yitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, because you are strangers in the land of Egypt. Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am the Lord your God. So here you have this dramatic transformation of a mitzvat lo ta'aseh, a prohibition, a negative commandment, into a mitzvat aseh, a positive obligation, right? Not only must you not oppress the stranger, but you must actively love the stranger. Now, I want to sort of say something that is a kind of a deflection, but also I think the most honest thing I can do in 3 minutes. Nobody is really sure what Leviticus meant 15 verses earlier when it said, love your neighbor as yourself. What exactly does that require of me? Is it emotional? Is it actional? Is it some combination of the two? And what do you mean love? Am I supposed to love my neighbor the way I love my wife? Unlikely. What does it actually mean? Is it a subject that has driven Jewish interpreters and modern academic Bible scholars crazy? And happy to talk about that later if that's, you know, of active interest tonight. But what is important here is whatever the radical obligation that is established towards my neighbor, towards my rea, more on that word in a minute, it is now extended beyond the boundaries of the kin group to include those who are not part of the kin group but live among the kin group. Backing up for a second, love your neighbor as yourself. I think neighbor is probably a very poor translation of rea. Rea, it seems to me, most likely means fellow member of the covenant. Those of you who read Mosaic probably saw Richard Elliot Friedman just like today arguing that it is universal. I'm sorry, I don't buy it. Many very well-intentioned liberal Jewish thinkers in the 20th century who I admire very much desperately wanted this to mean you should love everyone in the whole world. I don't think that's the truth. However, it's important to say, in a world where Jews have internalized traditional Christian anti-Judaism, not loving everyone, wait, let me say it differently. Not being obligated to love everyone in the world is not the same thing as you therefore have more license to treat them horribly. It may be that the obligation is to love those who are close to you and treat with dignity and respect those who are less so. I think it's actually perhaps an important distinction biblically. But now, in light of that, the Torah then does this amazing thing just 15 verses later. Remember how I told you that you should love the members of your kin group? Yeah, but not just them. Also those who are not your kin group but living with them. Love them too. Whatever you owe to the people around you who are insiders, you also owe to the people around you who are outsiders. Okay? Now that's in itself a pretty dramatically radical move. It insists that my boundaries of obligation are not limited by ethnic lines. Ethnic lines don't not matter, but they are not the last word in ethics. Right? Is that clear? Now, to take that one step further, and this I think is in many ways the most important thing for thinking about memory in Jewish ethics. These verses are so familiar to people who study the Bible that it is easy to miss how totally non-obvious they are. Because the Torah could have said, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. For hundreds of years, no one did anything for you. Therefore, to hell with the world, you don't owe anybody anything. There is nothing irrational about that response at all. Or the Torah could have said, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Nobody lifted a finger for you for hundreds of years. Therefore, you must spend your life cultivating a sense of solidarity with and empathy for those whom no one lifts a finger for. The fact that that is not obvious, I think, is really important because then you understand that the Torah is here actually taking one human impulse and asking us to cultivate it as opposed to its partner in crime, right? And I say partner in crime because it is sometimes tempting for people to imagine, this is, let's say, a sin of people on the political left. Well, my friends and I, we learn ethics from memory. But the people I hate, they learn brutality from memory, right? I think it's much more fruitful to actually ask the question, what are the ways that each of us learns both at the same time? And if you think about moments, and just to speak in a very personal way, think about moments in your life where you, if you've never had this experience, you can take a minute of gratitude. But many of us have had this experience sometimes. Some of us are daily bread. If you have had an experience of feeling vulnerable and defenseless and exploited in that vulnerability, one of the things you may notice is that there are two very different voices that emerge inside of you. One voice that says, everyone else who's in this situation, I feel responsible for. And another voice that says, if you had had my mother, you would know that I owe nobody anything, right? And the truth is, I think many people have both of those voices. I see that in counseling young adults all the time. So in light of that, the Torah here, I think it should be understood, is nurturing or calling on us to nurture one of those voices. To nurture that voice that says, how do I take my own suffering and lead it, enable it to generate a greater sense of responsibility for others? Or to say this in a slightly different way, we are responsible for shaping the memory that in turn shapes us. We are responsible for shaping the memory that in turn shapes us. Memory has no intrinsic moral meaning. Say something that might be profoundly offensive to some people. Auschwitz contains no intrinsic moral lessons. Auschwitz must be appropriated, I mean that word without any judgment at all, to yield moral lessons. And the moral lessons it can yield can be on every point on the political spectrum. Right? Auschwitz can yield Meir Kahana, and it can yield, I don't know, take your...
Primo Labor.
Okay, yeah. I mean, Auschwitz can yield a lot of things, right? That's the point. So we shape the memory that shapes us. Memory alone is, in pretentious philosophy speak, wildly underdetermined. Right? Memory is underdetermined. We shape, we make a decision about how memory is going to affect us. I mean, we don't only do that, right? Anyone who's ever suffered trauma knows I'm not just authoring my memory. I'm also wrestling with it and dealing with its implications. But on some level, when I ask, what are its implications? What are its normative implications for my life? What obligations does it generate in me? I am in part the author of that. And the Torah here, again, is doing something that is not obvious. Okay, now, so we have this. We have Exodus, the negative commandment, do not abuse, do not oppress. Leviticus, do not abuse, do not oppress, but rather love and treat as an insider. And then comes Deuteronomy with a really subtle magnification of Leviticus. Deuteronomy says, Ki Adonai Eloheichem, hu Eloheha Elohim va'Adoneha Adonim. The Lord your God is the Lord of all lords and the God of all gods. JPS, in a classic Jewish evasion of the pshat that these words seem to suggest, that there are other gods, but God is the greatest of all of them, translates God Supreme and Lord Supreme, which makes me think of a Motown band. But in any case, the God is Lord, God Supreme and Lord Supreme. It's like JPS's translation of Micha Mocha Ba'ilim Hashem, who is like you among the celestials. If you don't know what a celestial is, you have gotten what they're up to, because they don't want to say who is like you among the gods. Of course, if it doesn't mean gods, that verse is hardly a compliment. Imagine you call aside a 12th grader and say, you are the most powerful 8th grader I've ever seen. Right? This is not a big compliment. Micha Mocha Ba'ilim Hashem, who is like among the celestials, is a weak compliment. But anyway, let's walk back from the heretical precipice. The Lord your God is, right? God Supreme and Lord Supreme. Let's go with that. Ha'el Hagadol, Hagibor V'Hanora, familiar words. The great, the mighty, the awesome God, who lo yisa panim b'lo yikach shochad, who does not show favorites and will not be bribed. That's actually important. Will not be bribed is part of a way of saying God is so powerful that people who are wealthy and are used to getting away with things by bribing people, sorry, but I have what I need. Right? It's actually very important to Deuteronomy. One of the core themes of Deuteronomy is the idea that God is not impressed by wealth. This is a major theme of the book of Deuteronomy. God doesn't take bribes. You can't go to shul, say Shemon Esrei, and then go cheat on your taxes. I mean, descriptively, you can. But normatively, you can't. Okay? Now, how is God going to be described here? Ose mishpat yatom v'omana. God pleads the case of the orphan and the widow. The ohev ger, and God loves the stranger, loves the sojourner, latet lo lechem v'simla, and manifests that by giving him food and clothing. And then the next pasuk, v'havtem et ager, and you should love the stranger, kigerim yitem be'eretz mitzrayim. Now JPS here in gives you a great example of translation as commentary, and here it's a wonderful commentary. They add a word into the English, to verse 19. Instead of rendering, you must love the stranger, they catch the drift of verse 18 and they say, you too must love the stranger. Meaning, JPS has caught what Deuteronomy is doing here, which is saying the obligation to love the stranger is a form of walking in God's ways. Is imitatio Dei. It's not just you have to love the stranger because of what you've been through, but you have to love the stranger because who the God is that you claim to worship. If you worship a God who loves strangers, you too have to aspire to love the stranger. Right? It's like if someone says to you, I really love you, but your kids make me ill. The odds are you will find their love rather unpleasant. I think the Torah imagines God's response to human love that does not manifest and translate into love of the vulnerable as basically similar. What, you love me but hate my kids? I could do without your love. Go love somebody else. Or to put this in more positive, the aspiration of the spiritual life, as Deuteronomy imagines it, is that we should love those whom God loves. And who does God love? Widows, orphans, and especially in these verses, the stranger. So we have Leviticus here. Leviticus said, love because you know what it feels like and you've been through it. Deuteronomy says, you know what it feels like and you've been through it, but also you claim to worship a God who loves the vulnerable. What you've been through and who it is that you claim to worship. So in light of this fascinating progression, by the way, let me say this in one other way, at the hope of kind of making this more emotional and visceral. The history of religion is in many ways about people cutting God down to size so that God doesn't love anyone more than I do. The history of religion is in many ways about people cutting God down to their own size. So the Venn diagram of who God loves and who I love is totally overlapping. And no less importantly, the people I hate, God hates too. And in fact, religion as the Bible, as Deuteronomy here imagined, is quite the opposite, which is how do I push myself to learn to love those who I don't instinctively love? I might feel all kinds of other reactions to them, but because I know that God loves them and I aspire to worship that God, so I also am moved to try and love. Rather than bringing God down, I try to raise myself up. Now, what is this category? Who is this person that we're talking about? So as I said, right, the ger is a vulnerable outsider, not part of the kin group. Frank Spina, as I mentioned, says we should think about not just the present circumstance, stranger sojourner, but also the past. And he argues basically as follows, that based on ancient Near Eastern evidence, we know that a ger is a person who has left his or her place of origin because of social or political upheaval, war, famine, economic trouble, oppression, etc. I have myself in recent months, under the influence of my colleague Jason Rubenstein, suggested that perhaps we can translate ger as refugee. I now am a little bit not sure that's right. I would say the following thing. It's clear to me that for the Bible, all refugees are gerim, but not all gerim are refugees, right? Some gerim are immigrants. That is, right, and maybe Rabbi Rosen and I can talk about this, let's try to define our terms here, right? Who's a refugee? Who's an immigrant? Who's an asylum seeker? I mean, there's a lot to talk about there, but I'm not sure that it's fair or correct to translate ger as refugee so much as to say that a ger includes, obviously would include, a refugee, someone who has fled. Now, the word ger, and this is sort of fascinating, shares a root and may even be the same root as a biblical Hebrew word for fear. Gimel vav resh. Deuteronomy chapter 1 instructs judges in ancient Israel, lo taguru mipnei ish. Do not be afraid of anyone. That suggests that there is some connection between the stranger and fear. Two possible ways of reading this. One is, the ger is someone who arrives frightened or who left his or her former place out of fear. And perhaps more homiletically, I'm not really sure, possibility is the ger is someone your first reaction is to be afraid of. I'm skeptical that that second reading is plausible, but the first one is in itself powerful. You're reminded in the very nature of the word that part of what brought this person to this circumstance is the experience of being afraid. And to say that politically, perhaps your first instinct is always and in every circumstance to be afraid of him or her, and you are reminded that he or she is him or herself afraid. Now, just to be clear, that doesn't mean that there is never someone who enters your society that you should legitimately be afraid of. I think it's talking about something much more visceral and immediate than that. What does it mean to be viscerally afraid of the outsider or the newcomer? This doesn't mean suspending all thoughtfulness about what it means to try and be safe, right? But, okay, so fear is potentially intrinsic to the meaning of this word. In Akkadian, another ancient Semitic language, this root suggests an enemy, which I think is incredibly interesting. Because unlike New Testament Christianity, which talks about loving your enemy, here one could argue that the Hebrew Bible is arguing love the person who you are too quickly inclined to imagine is your enemy. Right? It's not talking about love your enemy. Although I hope to write something at some point about how the Hebrew Bible does not believe in loving your enemy necessarily, but it does basically tell you that if your enemy's animal is lost, you have to help your enemy. Right? Once again, the line there is not as clear and starkly dichotomous as you might think. The whole history of Hebrew school, again, will forgive me for that, but it's just not true. So the enemy, now think about this. What does Paro do in Exodus 1? The very beginning of the story, what Paro does is immediately demonize Israel and imagine that these outsiders are nothing more than a potential fifth column. The Torah demonstrates for you how thought about the outsider develops, right? Paro summons his people and says to them, right? And then this amazing Hebrew double entendre, which is just genius. Israel is rav ve'atzum mimenu, which can be translated equally effectively in two ways. More numerous than us, or too numerous for us. I mean, that's amazing. The whole history of fear of immigration is right there, right? More numerous than us, too numerous for us. The same Hebrew phrase means both of those things. Rav ve'atzum mimenu. Right? Paro immediately casts the outsider as an enemy, a scary force, and a potential fifth column, which then legitimates the very thing that the Torah prohibits us from doing to the outsider, which is oppression. Right? Now, here's the moral revolution part. And this is really kind of astounding, or so it seems to me at least. All over the ancient Near East, we have all kinds of mandates about how the king, one of the central responsibilities of the king, is to be responsible for the fate of widows and orphans. You see this all over the ancient world, which makes the following thing even more astonishing. Nowhere else in the ancient Near East, but in the Bible, is the category of the widow and the orphan expanded to include also the stranger. In other words, all over the ancient Near East, there is an obligation to be protective of our vulnerable. And in the Bible, we have the first steps in Western culture towards a sense of being obligated to be vulnerable, whether ours or not. That is, in many ways, one of the great moral revolutions of Tanakh. You know, as is always the case when you deal with ancient historians, there are some people who think there might be one Egyptian tablet that sort of suggests that maybe you're obligated to take care of the outsider. But in any case, right, even those people say this is an exception that proves the rule. Nowhere else is this talked about in any systematic way, let alone placed front and center in the social vision of a text or a society. And there, you might say, depending on your theology of revelation, definitely not our topic for tonight, that either Israel, out of its historical experience, or God, out of God's reflection on Israel's experience, discovers or implants this insight. This experience of being a vulnerable outsider is going to fundamentally shape your ethical vision. And I would argue, if I have time, I'll say just, you know, a couple sentences about this in a minute, that in many ways, one of the ways to understand biblical legislation in general is an attempt to create a radical alternative to Egypt. to create an anti-Egypt. And there's many examples of this in the Bible, it seems to me. Now, I wanted to show you, if you'll bear with me for 1 minute, something that I think is really beautiful and interesting. And here I'm borrowing something from a Bible scholar named Patrick Miller, just to give credit where it's due. If you turn to the next page, I think it's kind of fascinating. And it's really, really subtle. This is a story of Lot, trying to protect his guests from the cruel Sodomites, who hate outsiders, who believe outsiders are there only to be exploited. Now remember, Lot is an immigrant to Sodom. And he begins in chapter 19, verse 7, Vayomer, and he said to them, Al na'achai tarehu, do not my brothers, my fellow, remember, after l'reah ha'kamocha, do not my brothers do horrible things. And they respond in verse 9, I'm in the middle of that verse, Vayomru, ha'echad balagur, vayishpot shafot. He says, you're my brothers. And they say, look at this gear. He thinks he's going to tell us how to live. What you have here in this incredibly subtle way is the pathos that Genesis already wants us to think about. About, here's a man who says, look, I've been living here a while. I'm one of you. We're in this conversation together. You're my brothers. And they say, brothers? Excuse me? You're a gear. You have no right to lecture us about anything. You're an outsider. And that's the sort of undercurrent of the whole story. Don't import your... You are always going to be that. Marginal, outside, and vulnerable. That's the way we like it here. By the way, Miller also argues something totally fascinating about Genesis 12, when Abraham, in the very first moment after being covenanted with God, goes down to Egypt, Lagur, to be a stranger. Miller says, you know, everyone spends all his time thinking, does Avram do the right thing with Sarah, the wrong thing? Does he sin against Sarah by saying, right, famously, tell them you're my sister? And Miller says, you know, that's catching the wrong lens. What the Torah wants to do in verse 12 is show you from the very first moment that people who are strangers are so vulnerable that they often find themselves in impossible moral predicaments because they're unsafe. And sometimes in order to protect your vulnerable sense of safety, you end up doing things that you would otherwise never do. He says, I'm not trying to defend what Abraham does here. I'm trying to understand why the text does this in this moment. Why in the very first moment that God covenants with Israel, does Israel then immediately have to have the experience of powerlessness in a situation of being an outsider? Because that's the whole story. That's the story of Israel. Is you're going to be powerless in an outsider. What do you choose to learn from that? Okay, let me take just a couple more steps and then I'll stop and... we can move to the next stage. There's one other move here that happens that I think is equally impressive and also, frankly, daunting in the extreme. I said before, carefully, that all over the ancient Near East, the king is responsible for the fate of the widow and the orphan. We have echoes of that in Tanakh. Psalm 72, for example, imagines that the ideal king is one whose identity is about protecting the poor. Ezekiel imagines God firing the kings of Israel because they fail to protect the poor and rather exploit them instead. But the Bible, most of the Bible, does something totally wild, which is to say, it is not the king, or better, it is not the king alone who is responsible for the fate of the widow and the orphan. It is you, every last one of you. This is what I call, right, the democratization of moral responsibility. It is no longer possible after the Bible to say, well, the people in power, they have to protect the weak. I just live here. Comes Shmot. Parashat Mishpatim is dramatic in its way and says, you know who's responsible for the widow and the orphan? Every last one of you. Which of I, the command, is in the plural. Lo tonu oto. You, all of you, shall not oppress him. And I don't have the time to develop this at any length, but you can look at the next source, where Ibn Ezra, in this totally amazing way, one of the great medieval commentaries and an amazing reader, basically says, why is it that in Parashat Mishpatim, there's a weave, the plural, the singular, the plural, the singular? He says, basically, because the Torah wants to tell you in its own understated way, I mean, this is like one of the most haunting sentences, I think, in all of Jewish writing, the moral status of those who witness oppression and do nothing about it is exactly equivalent to the moral status of those who oppress themselves. In other words, there's no such thing in Jewish ethics as an innocent bystander. Such a thing is unimaginable. A bystander is a participant. Which leads, I think it's fair to say, to one of the hardest questions that anyone who wants to take texts like this seriously has to wrestle with, which is essentially, how do I allow these texts to land in a way that motivates rather than paralyzes? It is very easy to hear texts like this and just be totally paralyzed by them, right? The Torah here says, just to be clear, you're responsible and you're responsible and you're responsible and you're responsible too. I know you're gonna say, what did I do? I'm just living in my nice little suburban house. I never hurt anyone. Actually, you did. You were complicit. Those words are supposed to make you swallow really hard. That's their point. And at the risk of, again, you know, saying something that is kind of maybe a little overly provocative, one of the great horrible inclinations that inheritors of the Bible have always had is to domesticate the Bible by admiring it. Isn't it amazing that the Torah in the ancient Near East did this totally radical thing? What's for dinner? As opposed to really asking the question, okay, so it made this radical claim. What is the parallel of that in this moment? Now, I personally, just to be clear, am totally skeptical of those right or left who think there is always or even often or sometimes even ever a one-to-one correspondence between a biblical verse and a contemporary political policy. Right? But that is not the same thing as saying, oh, therefore I don't have to think about it. Or the most absurd line in the history of American Judaism, I don't want my rabbi to talk about politics. Translation, I'd rather my rabbi keep Torah out of shul. I mean, that's what it is. That's it, right? I mean, I don't even know what that means. Now, how do you talk about politics in a way that is menschlich, that is not convinced that I have a direct line to God and I know how God votes on every issue in the like White Plains City Council, right? But how do I really hear the biblical mandate as seriously? The danger is, it's funny, because when I say that, there's no one-to-one correspondence, people kind of take a deep breath, okay. I don't mean it as an okay. I mean it as opening up a possibility for well-intentioned people to have real conversations. So I don't think that these verses generate a direct conclusion. Here is Exodus's view of contemporary American refugee policy. I do think that it's very obvious that they make the claim that the demonization of dehumanization and dehumanization of immigrants and refugees is always and everywhere morally and theologically intolerable and a desecration of everything God holds dear, to say that point humbly. But that's, again, not the same thing as saying, I now know exactly how many people should be let in this year based on reading this verse in the Bible. It seems to me that people on the right and left could both use in different ways the ability to hear that, right? It's fascinating, right? The state of America, right? You hear, like, the right talks about the religious left, such as it is, right, thinking it knows too much. And you hear the left talk about the Christian right. And very rarely do you hear, it's funny, everything I just said applies to me also. Okay. Now, I want to give you one last example, and with this I'm going to stop, because I think it's actually kind of just fascinating. And no one ever talks about this. So Deuteronomy 23 is talking about the laws of a runaway slave. Context. Everywhere in the ancient Near East, this is source 7, everywhere in the ancient Near East, it is assumed that it is forbidden to harbor a runaway slave, and one is obligated to hold on to that slave until one is able to discern who its master is and return it. Comes Deuteronomy 23 and says, you may not turn over a slave to its master. You may not do that. And then in the Bible's inimitable way, asher yinatzel elecha, the same word that God uses, what God is doing for the Israelite slaves, v'hit salti, the person who is literally saves himself by coming to you, you may not give back that slave. And then this amazing verse, imcha yeshev, with you shall he dwell, bekir becha, in your midst, b'makom asher yivchar, in the place that he chooses, b'achad sharecha, in one of your gates, batovlo, wherever he chooses, lo tonenu, do not oppress him. 5 different formulations of wherever he damn well pleases. The runaway slave comes and says, I'd like your living room. You have no choice but to say, okay. This is a conscious assault on the entire history of slave law in the ancient Near East. conscious assault and dismantling of slave law in the ancient Near East. And I want to take it one step further, which is amazing. The phrase "Bamakom asher yivchar," in the place where he chooses, appears 18 times in Deuteronomy. 17 times it refers to God's choosing Jerusalem as the place where God's temple will be. And the 18th time it refers to the place that the slave chooses to live in your land. Those of you who are interested in this, I have an essay on our website called "Why Runaway Slaves Are Like God," which is about this, right? It's a way of saying the absolute radical freedom that God has to decide what is God's dwelling place, that's the freedom that a runaway slave has in ancient Israel. Why? You are a nation of runaway slaves. You're going to give slaves back? You mean you learned nothing at all? Your memory is such that it has no moral implications at all? So what do these verses mean in a time? We now live in a moment, which is an astonishing thing, right? For people who just, you know, tell the story of having been slaves, there are more slaves in the world today than there have ever been in the history of the human race. So what are the implications of this verse beyond admiring it? Those, I think, are really urgent conversations. That would actually mean that we actually took the Torah seriously, which would be the greatest moral revolution that ever happened. Okay. Last sentence. What I think is amazing about this is if you read contemporary psychological research on empathy, you find two schools on this. Some who emphasize, wait a minute, the problem with empathy is we're very good at empathizing with people who are just like us and very bad at empathizing with people who are not like us. And then you have other people who say, yes, but amazingly, when you want to create crossover, where you want people to begin to see other people as human also, you create situations where they can empathize. So empathy is both a barrier, but it is potentially a bridge. And you see here how the Torah dramatically, right, really wants to create a situation where empathy is a bridge and not a barrier. To expand one's empathic sense so that it includes not just those who are like you, but those who are vulnerable to your power. Okay, thank you very much. I am now going to call Rabbi Jenny Rosen, and we're going to have a conversation. And then we'll take questions and comments. Okay, so we can pass forward questions. Let me, in this moment, welcome our friend, Rabbi Jenny Rosen. My one moment of formality for tonight is I'm going to read a biography, lest I not do Rabbi Rosen justice. Rabbi Jenny Rosen is Vice President for Community Engagement at HIAS, the International Jewish Refugee Organization, where she is mobilizing the Jewish community to advance the rights and lives of refugees in the United States and around the world. Prior to coming to HIAS, Rabbi Rosen played a catalytic role in building the Jewish social justice movement and the field of Jewish service as director of the Jewish Life and Values Program at the Cummings Foundation. She was also campus rabbi at Columbia and Barnard. Important fact, my wife's Hillel rabbi. A founding board member of Avodah, the Jewish Service Corps, and Repair the World, Rabbi Rosen has on two occasions been named to the Forward's 50 Most Influential Jews in America. She was ordained by Hebrew Union College. She was a Wexner Graduate Fellow, and most importantly, is an incredibly thoughtful and effective activist, and it's our privilege to have you with us tonight, Jenny. Thank you. So let me just state at the outset that I'm going to ask Rabbi Rosen a kind of a mix of personal questions, trying to understand what makes someone do the work they do, and also some more concrete questions about policy. So I want to start by asking you if you'd be willing to talk personally a little bit, if you would. We live in a world utterly suffused with suffering. And of all the people in the world who need help, why have you decided that of all of those populations, refugees are where you want to put your heart and soul?
Thanks, Shai. It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation and for such inspirational Torah. So as you heard in my bio, my rabbinate has really been shaped around mobilizing the Jewish community around issues of social and economic justice, engaging young people through Hillel, building the field of Jewish social justice with many great colleagues, some of who are in this room, when I was at the Cummings Foundation. And when I left the Cummings Foundation, I was really looking to mobilize in a little bit more of a hands-on, sort of down from the 30,000 foot of philanthropy to one step closer to a real issue. And the issue of refugee feels to me to not only be one of the most pressing issues of our time, but to be, as we've been learning over the last hour, a profoundly Jewish issue. There are many issues that our values call us to act upon, and the issue of refugees is one that our history also calls us to and puts us in a really unique position, I think, to be activists and champions and witnesses and change agents. And it's, we've been talking a lot about Ger in ancient times. Of course, generation after generation, for really the entire history until recently of the Jewish people, we have been refugees. We've been forced to flee. We've been strangers in a strange land. And we've not only survived, but we've thrived. And I think that that gives us both an additional level of responsibility. Many of the sort of, it's not only empathy, but the identification and the, it's in our DNA as a people to have been the stranger and to have been the refugee. And so I think that this makes it a particularly powerful issue for the Jewish community to respond to, not only as a sense of responsibility, but it also gives us added power. And I think we'll be talking, I think, over this next period about how is this issue playing out in current time and what's the role for the Jewish community. And I think it puts us in a particularly powerful role, one of which we really can't step back from at this moment when there are more refugees and displaced people than there have been in recorded history. If I sat here a year ago, I would have told you since World War II. Sitting here now, I have to say it is in all of recorded history. 65 million is it's a difficult number to fathom, and that difficulty doesn't mean that we can step away.
So it might be useful in light of what you've just said to try, it might be useful in light of what you just said to begin by maybe defining our terms. Can you briefly, I mean, obviously these are huge dissertation topics, but talk about and differentiate between immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced people? I mean, that's a lot, right? And in light of that, what is Hayes's work exactly?
Sure. So, and you actually did the perfect setup in many ways in the last hour. But when you said that all Gerim are immigrants, but not all Gerim are refugees, I think that's what you said, right? Not all Gerim are refugees, but all Gerim are immigrants. So immigrants are people who have migrated from one place to another. And that is the broadest category. And that could be for many reasons. That could be for economic reasons, that could be because they're fleeing, that could be because they're going to be with a loved one in another place, that could be for any host of reasons. Refugees are a subset within that, and it's a legal term. The whole concept of refugee grew out of the Holocaust. The 1951 Refugee Convention grew out of the ashes of the Holocaust and the nations of the world coming together and saying, we can't let this happen again. We can't be in a situation again where we send people back to their deaths, where we shut our doors to them. And so the Refugee Convention is a legal convention, a legal edict that says, if you can show that you have reasonable, credible fear of returning to your country based on one of five things, based on your race, based on your nationality, based on your religion, your political opinion, or your social group. Social group could be, for example, if you're LGBT, would be an example of a social group. If you can prove that you have credible fear of returning, you should be granted refugee status and not sent back to that country. And 148 countries signed that agreement, including the United States, including many countries in Europe, including Israel. And that is the entire framework that continues to this day. So a refugee is a legal status, and when a person leaves one country and flees to another, they then need to be granted refugee status, and they become a refugee. Now, an asylum seeker is someone who's fleeing for those same reasons, but doesn't yet have that status. So we may talk about this a little bit more, in a few minutes, but refugees who are resettled in this country have refugee status before they ever come to this country. And when we talk about how many refugees does the United States resettle, we're talking about people who get their refugee status elsewhere, go through a whole security vetting and healthcare vetting and health screening, and then come to this country through a whole resettlement process that was established in 1980, the contours of which are sort of done today. An asylum seeker is someone who just shows up. And they show up for all of the same reasons of flight, but they don't yet have that status. And obviously, you don't determine a certain number of people who are going to come to your country seeking asylum. And in our country, people come seeking asylum from all over. A large majority, as you can imagine, are from Central America and the Triangle region, where there's tremendous violence because our borders allow for that. Europe, for example, has many more asylum seekers coming from Syria, let's say, or Lebanon, or Jordan, or Turkey. So that's an asylum seeker. And one of the things you may have been hearing about also is when we talk about deportations, refugees are not at risk for deportation because they have come with legal status. Asylum seekers are very much at risk for deportation. And one of the things that's going on now is, are people being sent back to their deaths in the very way that the Refugee Convention tries to prevent. The fourth is internally displaced people. And that is somebody who has fled for all the same reasons but hasn't crossed an international line. A refugee or an asylum seeker, by definition, is going into another country. So there are a lot of internally displaced people, you know, 7 million internally displaced people within Syria. Ukraine is another place where we hear about a lot of internally displaced people. So when we say 65 million, that includes, that doesn't include immigrants, that includes refugees, asylum seekers, and displaced people. Highest, just to highest is, work is focused on refugees and asylum seekers. So we certainly are part of a lot of the coalitions and broader work around immigration reform, but Hayes's work really focuses on refugees and asylum seekers, people who are literally fleeing for their lives.
Great, thank you. So let's shift a minute and talk about policy. You know, one of the things we often hear are the two caricatured extremes. One position is keep them all out. And many people would say that's obviously morally intolerable. And the other extreme, let them all in. And that is implausible for all kinds of reasons. So how does one begin to think and talk about a sane middle between those two options? How do we talk about this in a helpful way?
Well, I think that there are certain boundaries that are givens. I think that if people come to this country fleeing for their lives, we have a moral and legal commitment to hear their case with representation before a judge and determine whether that is indeed the case. And if it is the case, we absolutely, one of the firm lines is that we cannot be deporting people back to their deaths. That is not who we are as a country. And that is not what we stand for, and that's not what our nation has been built upon. So I think that that is one sort of clear boundary. I think that there is a lot of discussion, and that sadly much of it has been stalled, around sort of what are the best contours for immigration policy. I think the underlying foundation needs to be one in which it is a humane policy, and that it is one that is reflective of the dignity and respect that is among the founding values of not only us as Jews, but us as a nation. And so, you know, the policies of separating families, of separating at the border, you know, children from their parents, of deporting people without either fair trial or children without representation, I think there's some very clear lines. I think that if we approach this with a sense of what are the underlying basic values and assumptions that we share as a nation, and as a nation that is built upon being a nation of immigrants, there is absolutely a middle ground. And I think, you know, part of the challenge, and I think we'll you know, talk about this in a few minutes, is the way in which people demonize sort of the other, whether that's the other in a political term or the other in terms of the, you know, the gear. But I think it's really a question of coming back to what are our essential values? What are our essential values as a people and as a nation?
Okay, so let me, if I could, I want to ask you a kind of question that comes at this at an angle, and I apologize, this is going to be my one longish question, so I hope you'll bear with me. I was reading something recently by the philosopher Christopher Freiman, who says the following: the benefits of liberalized immigration to the global poor are so overwhelming that it is flatly unethical to withhold them. he writes that, quote, only one policy has been shown to effectively bring the global poor up to the living standards of the global rich, allowing them to move across borders toward economic opportunity. Given how desperately poor many people around the world are, Fryman and others say, it is, quote, morally indefensible to deprive them of the opportunity to increase their income by over 1,000%, especially when the cost of doing so is making someone hundreds of times richer, only 5% poorer. That's like, this is his image, cutting in front of someone dying of thirst because you want that last bottle of Aquafina to brush your teeth. And yet, others argue, we've heard many of those voices in the past year, that arguments like this are too simple and even facile. Arguments like Fryman's, they say, fail to take seriously the fear, frustration, and even desperation many people in America feel. I was struck recently by an exchange between the journalist Andrew Sullivan and the Trump advocate who sought to be anonymous, Michael Anton. Sullivan writes the following, okay? And you should just relish this first phrase. The Davoisie, that means the people who hang out at Davos, the Davoisie were too busy lifting foreigners out of poverty and celebrating the latest disruptive tech invention to cast a glance toward, say, the beleaguered inhabitants of Kansas or Michigan. Anton admired Trump, Sullivan says, largely because, and these are Anton's words, because he single-handedly revived talking about government serving its own citizens first. Trump understood that the American idea is a compact, quote, for the American people and not for foreigners, immigrants, unless we choose to welcome them, or anyone else. The argument is essentially that the American elites, love those terms, dismissal of these truths, its reduction of all resistance to cultural and demographic change as crude racism or xenophobia, only deepens the sense of siege that many Americans feel. So, there are these two very dramatic poles, right? It is blatantly unethical, it is morally intolerable not to open one's borders. And then the other voice that says, do you have any idea what's going on in this country? That's the wrong conversation. You're talking the language that we totally don't relate to or connect to or feel compelled by. So I want to ask you how you, really first and foremost as a human being, but also as an activist, as a rabbi, how do you respond to these kinds of descriptions of American yearnings and frustrations as they kind of intersect with urgent conversations about refugees at this moment? It's a big question, obviously, but...
Well, I think that it often gets set up as an either-or and as a zero-sum game, that either we care about the other, we care about foreigners, or we care about Americans. Either we are only looking out for the elite, or we care about, you know, the factory worker in the Midwest. And I think that it's not a zero-sum game in the same way that, you know, there's enough food to feed, I mean, going back to the original context that you said, there's enough food in the world to feed everyone. It's not a question of, it's coming at it from a place of limitation as opposed to a place of abundance. America is a country that has always integrated generations of immigrants, and that's been part of what has been the engine of America. And that is true for all of these people who are now, you know, identifying as Americans as opposed to foreigners. Similarly, though, if we see it as it's the immigrants as opposed to our fellow Americans, it also sets it up as an either-or. I think that understanding that it's not all about racism and xenophobia and sort of immediately jumping to that is its own form of, it's a term that I hear more millennials use, but of sort of othering, right? I never knew that was a verb until recently, to other
it
someone.
It wasn't.
But it's its own form of othering, right? So the question becomes, you know, do we jump to they're racist, they're xenophobic, or do we understand that they are having their own set of very understandable reactions to the other that we all have? I mean, it's exactly what you just taught for the last hour around the ger. So why do we need the commandment to love the ger, to protect the ger, to not oppress the ger? Because, you know, it doesn't say don't oppress your friend. It doesn't say don't oppress, you know, your sister. this is the role of religion, right? It's to cultivate that sense in ourselves. It's what are we cultivating in ourselves? We're cultivating and nurturing a sense of being able to override what is often that first instinct. And to understand that that is part of what is going on for, you know, these people who elites may see as, or that they may see, you know, us as. So I think it's all actually part of the same, sort of the what's happening in America between different polarization forces in America and different populations in America is its own, you know, reflection of what we're talking about on a American foreigner level and what it means to be the gayer as opposed to be of your own kin, right? You know, is it my kin, you know, in, you know, the Upper West Side, it sort of becomes your, you know, those are your people, and we talk about sort of who are your people in America and the incredible polarization. So I think that an understanding of coming at it with a sense of these are all of our instincts, right? We all, in our own way, struggle with this sense of the other, and how do we cultivate an overcoming of that? And I think the other, you know, that's on the sort of theological level. I think on a really tachlis level, it's also understanding that from an economics perspective, it's also not an either or, right? Refugees and immigrants require an initial sort of sense of support and literal support, but they're also what revitalizes our economy. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, places in Maine and upstate New York are welcoming refugees eagerly, because they're often in need of increasing their populations, reviving depressed economies. These are, and refugees, I think the latest study shows that it's a tenfold return. So if you invest, you know, $4,800 initially, in a very short period of time, there's 10 times that gets returned to the economy. So I think it's, again, this combination of, you know, theological framing and understanding of what people's emotional experience is and the real tachlis of the economics of it.
So let me just pick up on something that you just said that really struck me. And I'm curious, you know, even as a mother, you know, as a parent, how do we go from thinking about a sense of shared humanity as an ideal, an idea, to the point of seeing shared humanity as a visceral experience? You know, I was struck last year, I was reading a couple of essays by a sociologist, I hope I'm remembering her name correctly, Kirsten Munro, I believe is her name, who has spent a lot of time interviewing Europeans who saved Jews during the Holocaust. And after all her research, she says, you know, I only found one characteristic that almost everyone who hid Jews shared in common, which is that if you ask them what it was about, they all had some immediate kind of intuitive discourse of shared humanity. They would say, well, what do you mean? They're people. And that was the answer. I expected something, you know, really complicated. It was just, sorry, like, no, they were people and I'm a person, and so I have obligations to them. But, you know, and we know, right, religion often functions in precisely the opposite way, in the kind of the metaphysicalization of othering. Right? It's not just that you're not me, it's that you're not me and God detests you too. And God wants you, right, downtrodden. How do we, like, when I talk to my kids at breakfast tomorrow, right, how do I help them have a sense that people with whom they appear on the surface to share nothing are human beings like them who make a claim on them? I can't think of a more important but difficult question than that. So I'm curious, like, how you would help us with that, or, you know.
Well, I think for kids, it comes from experience. I mean, that might be true for all of us, but I think it's certainly true for children. I'm not a parenting expert. But I think kids aren't going to come to that in a theoretical sense. They're going to come to that because they have an experience with someone who is different from them, who they then come to understand that they have a connection to. And I think, you know, this is gonna take us into a whole different, you know, area of this conversation. And I think that one of the challenges is the way to which we're so bifurcated. I mean, this is not new, this is not a chiddush, but I think, you know, our society has become so much more segregated and so much more sectionalized. and our children often have less and less contact with people who are other than themselves and different than themselves. Right. I think this is a particular challenge in the Jewish community, frankly. And I think that sense of shared humanity is going to come from their having direct experiences. And that's certainly our experience. I mean, just to take this back to the sphere of refugees, I think that is absolutely our experience with people's take of sort of who are refugees. They are scary, they are other, they are threatening, and that as people, and we've been experiencing, you know, as more and more of the Jewish community has really been engaging with refugees in their own communities, and welcoming families, you know, in their area, and doing sort of one-on-one work and doing advocacy hand-in-hand with refugees, that is really what changes, that is what transcends people's sets of assumptions, and that's what transcends that sense of otherness. It's cliche, but I think it's really true. That's what builds a sense of empathy. It takes it out of the sort of heady theoretical and really into the kishkas. One thing I'll just, Hayez is 136-year-old Jewish organization. It was founded in 1881, and for the first 120 years, Hayez rescued and resettled Jewish refugees. So all the waves of refugees who came to this country and immigrants who came to this country through Ellis Island. If I won't go through the history, I think most people in this room know the history of the waves of Jewish immigration, but that's who Hayez served. And after the last wave of Soviet Jews came to this country, Hayez really had a choice to make, which was, do we close up shop now that there are virtually, thank God, really no, very, very few Jewish refugees left? Obviously, the few who are left, we help. Or do we take our expertise and relationships and experience and work with refugees of all ethnic and religious backgrounds? And we chose the latter. And so today we work with refugees of all backgrounds. And that was a very obvious, clear pivot. We like to say that we used to help refugees because they were Jewish, and now we help refugees because we're Jewish. And I share that because I think encapsulated in that pivot is some of what we're talking about this evening, mm-hmm. right? It's a sense of who are we, and what do we do with our experience? And does that experience mean that we solidify and hunker down, I think was the language you used, or do we take that as a call and a platform from which we as Jews work for all Gary?
Okay, so we have received an incredible array of questions about the Torah, about halakha, about contemporary politics, and I'm going to apologize to people that we are not going to be, oh, we got some more. We are not going to get to all of them, obviously, but I want to ask you about one that comes up in various forms here. What do we do about the ger who wants to harm us? Or if I could frame the question maybe slightly theoretically, could we talk a little bit about terrorism and security concerns in the context of immigration? Because, as you know, fear of unrestricted immigration is a big piece of what led Britain to vote in favor of leaving the European Union. And when there are acts of terrorism committed by radical Islamists here in America, that always amplifies Americans' fear of letting Muslims in. So I want to ask you, maybe I can put it this way. Are Americans who talk about fear of Muslim immigration, are their fears illegitimate? Or is it that their fears are sometimes legitimate, but those fears should be overridden by other pressing moral concerns? Like, how do you talk about that?
So I think they're two different. When we talk as a Jewish community about fear of refugees, and immigrants, I hear it mostly in two ways. I hear it in terms of terrorism, and I hear it in terms of anti-Semitism. And I think that those need to be taken in different ways, and I think they have different responses. I think that in terms of terrorism, one of the things that I think is not well understood is that when a refugee comes to this country, less than 1% of the world's refugees get resettled in a third country, right? So the Refugee Convention that I talked about before says that instead, one of three things should happen to refugees. They shouldn't be sent back. there are three what they call in refugee speak durable solutions. So one is repatriation. Right? That's what most refugees want. Most refugees want to go home. So most of the Syrian refugees want it. It's what we would want. And sadly, that's not possible for most refugees. Or if it's possible, it's unlikely to be in their lifetime. It happens sometimes. You think about Rwanda, you know, as an example. But it's unlikely to happen in their lifetime. The second is integration. And this is what happens for the majority of refugees. They have to integrate into the country that they fled to. So let's say that someone's fleeing from the Congo. This will come to your question. And they flee to Uganda. They then need to make a life for themselves and their family in Uganda. And a lot of HIAS's work internationally is with refugees. We have 12 offices around the world where we work with refugees who have fled to those countries in Africa, in South America, in Europe. The third option is repatriation in a third country. And this is, for many refugees, the most hopeful option, and it is available to less than 1% of the world's refugees, a startling statistic. And that is simply because there are not countries that have opened up sort of available spots for that. And the United States, although we take a relatively paltry number of refugees, is the leader in this. We actually have the largest number that we resettle. And so what we do has ramifications for the whole world. So that 1% are generally the most vulnerable refugees. They have to then be identified as, you need resettlement in a third country. So that might be a woman who suddenly finds herself as a single woman head of household, or LGBT, or victims of torture, or sometimes people who are still being pursued by their pursuers. I'm thinking of someone I met in Uganda who was still being pursued to be killed by the folks who were in Congo pursuing them. So they needed to be resettled in a third country. So once they're identified for resettlement in a third country, then becomes a very lengthy process of vetting. And that's the sort of security vetting that we've been hearing a lot about, and health screening. And that generally takes 18 to 24 months and involves five federal agencies, counterterrorism, the State Department, Department of Defense, the FBI. It's a very rigorous process, and I think that it's important for people to understand that we really already have extreme vetting, and that refugees who come to this country are extremely well vetted. And so when we talk about the risks of terrorism, I think that there's been an unfortunate conflation of refugees and terrorism. I think we saw it with the attacks in Paris in November of 2015. There was a real upswing in anti-refugee and anti-Muslim sentiment after those attacks that had everything to do with a false association between ISIS, which was real, and the increase of Syrian refugees, which was not connected to this particular attack. So I think that and it's very different than Europe, right? Folks who are coming to Europe are literally streaming in. So I think that there's a lot of fear of terrorism that is not grounded in reality and in fact, and I think that we don't have to be as anxious about that. I think that the questions about anti-Semitism and why would we welcome, I hear this a lot, why would we welcome people to our country who hate us? And why would we as a Jewish community want to go out of our way to welcome refugees to our country? And I think that the response to this is multifold. I think that, for one thing, when refugees are coming to this country, the last thing in their mind is Jews, right? They're thinking about, it's a little bit sort of like where we see ourselves as the center of the world. It's not what's on their mind. They're thinking about, how do I survive and how do I make a life for myself and my family? Now, having said that, are there many refugees who we, HIAS, the second major part of our work is doing resettlement work in this country, mostly in partnership with Jewish family service agencies across the country. So we do resettlement work in 22 communities around the country. And we do hear from our clients, I was raised to hate Jews. We just had a conversation, one of my colleagues just had a conversation in Columbus with a family, and the man in the family said, I was raised to hate Jews. He said, but then I came here, and who met me at the airport? And who helped me and my family get settled and enroll our kids at school? And who did I call at 5 in the morning when I couldn't get the stove to work? He said, this has totally challenged my understanding of who the Jews are. Now that's on an anecdotal level, but I do think there's a role for the Jewish community to play in changing this narrative. I also think, not on an anecdotal level, but on a kind of more theological level, who are we? Who are we as a people? Are we as a people going to say, because of what you believe, you will not be welcome in our country? I don't think that that's what we as Americans or we as Jews want to be saying. And that comes to the second part, which I think it is a kind of overcoming our fear. And I think that it's not unconnected to the fear of the ger, right? We may all experience somewhere in our kishkas a fear of the other, a fear of the stranger. But it's then, what do we do with that fear? And do we say our country is closed to you? Or do we cultivate something that overrides that fear and then work to actually change the reality on the ground? And the last thing I'll say is that I think the United States has a very good track record, certainly relative to Europe, of integration. I think we look at Europe and often think that's what's going to happen here. And you know, I don't want to throw Europe under the bus in this conversation, but I think it's very different in America. I think that we are a country that at our best and at our best moments, which is most of our moments, not all of history, we happen to be in a moment now that I think is more reminiscent of the 20s, frankly, which was one of our more shameful moments, and then around the Holocaust, another more shameful moment, but of integrating generations of refugees and immigrants into our nation. Madeleine Albright is famous for saying, you know, she was a refugee in England and then she was a refugee here. And she said, in England, everybody said to me, when are you going home? That was the question everyone asked. When do you get to go home? And she said, when I came to America, everyone asks, when are you becoming a citizen? And I think that encapsulated in that is a reflection of who we are as a nation and what that enables us to be as a nation and as a people.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time, so I want to ask you, if I could, just to sort of play the opposite poll for a minute. As someone who works full-time in the world of refugee resettlement and advocacy, what do you think are the best arguments for tighter restrictions on immigration? That is, what arguments do you hear that give you pause in your own work? Or are there any?
So are we going to take this question instead of what people can do?
We're going to take both. We're going to take both.
Okay.
Worry not.
You mentioned earlier that you might ask this question. And I thought a lot about it. I honestly don't have pause. I feel a huge sense of urgency. I feel a sense of our being in a real crisis moment right now, in which we as a nation are at risk of closing our doors to people who are literally fleeing for their lives. We are just yesterday, so there are two, as I'm sure you're aware, when the executive order came out, there are two major court cases, Maryland, of which Hyas is one of the main plaintiffs, and the appeal was heard yesterday, the case that stayed the order, and then the Hawaii case, the appeal of which is on the 15th. And so we are, you know, sort of literally waiting for the verdict. I think that we're at a moment when the risks for our nation are not the risk of immigrants and refugees. The risk to our nation is, who are we going to be as a people? Who are we going to be as a Jewish people as to whether we are quiet or active or very active and loud and really leading in this moment? And who are we going to be as a nation? And so the pause that I have is not around, what are the risks of immigrants and refugees? There's no question in my mind that they bring much more to our country than they extract, and that with the exception of people who came as slaves and Native Americans, none of us would be here were we not a nation of immigrants. And I think that if we have, I trust that we can see our way through to serious, humane policies that enable us to be the nation that we set out to be years ago and that we have been most of the time since then, and that we're in a very treacherous moment in history. And it's really up to, I mean, to go back to what you were saying about, you know, standing witness to oppression. We're at a moment where it's up to every single, you know, one of us in this room and in our nation, whether we're going to sit by or whether we're going to stand up.
I look at this list with great pain because there are some amazing questions we have not gotten to. But I promised I would end with this question, right? There are many people in this room, vast majority of whom I know, who feel enormous passion about questions of immigration reform and relief for refugees. And I want to pose to you on behalf of those people. People want to support refugees in concrete ways. What would you tell them, tell us, we ought to be doing?
I'm so glad you asked. So I think there are four things. One is education, not just of yourselves, but of other people. This Purim, we launched a Be Esther campaign, and the one pager that was downstairs on the table that says how to talk to your friends and family about refugees, we sort of were joking that it was like, don't just call the castle, don't just advocate, but call Aunt Sue. You know, that it's hardest often to talk to those closest to us about things we don't see eye to eye on. And this goes back to the polarization that we were talking about before. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to talk to the people who are our friends and colleagues and family members around some of these tough issues. And so this, you know, sort of one-page guide was meant to really give support to each of us to have those conversations with people and to educate people around refugees, because I think there's a lot of misinformation and that fuels the fear. I also would really encourage you on the education front, on our website, on our resources page, is a great set of resources around frequently asked questions, holiday resources, Jewish sources. It's really a good place to go if you're looking for information and to continue to educate yourself. The second thing is that I think the most important thing right now is advocacy. That is what's most needed. It's not, I know, always the easiest. It's not what everybody gravitates to necessarily. Having said that, I think we're in a moment where many people are kind of rediscovering or maybe discovering for the first time their activist selves. And I think that there is a lot of advocacy that's needed, both in terms of direct advocacy, calling your members of Congress, reaching out to the administration, letters and phone calls. There, you know, again, on our website, there are all sorts of resources. We're training synagogues to do in-district meetings with their representatives. Even representatives who are supportive of refugees still need to hear from you. So advocacy is really important. And the other kind of advocacy is more the public displays, which we are seeing are making a difference, public displays. We had a big national action on February 12th. I think some of you were there. Thank you for coming out in the sleet storm. We had almost 1,000 people in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. And there were 20 actions going on around the country. On June 6th, we're catalyzing vigils across the country. June 6th is the date that the St. Louis was sent back. And so please be in touch. I know that there are several vigils happening in New York, including in Manhattan, on June 6th. Those kinds of public displays are so important. If you're going to other town hall meetings or rallies, print out signs from our website, ways to really raise up the issue of refugees. The third is through direct service. If you can imagine what it's like to arrive in this country right now as a refugee, half of whom are Muslim, it's so important for refugees to experience a sense of welcome. Now, in Manhattan, as you can imagine, we don't resettle a lot of refugees for all sorts of reasons, you know, many of which come back to the cost of housing. However, having said that, there are a number of opportunities to support refugees in a variety of ways through English tutoring. We're actually about to launch a whole new set of opportunities with asylum seekers as well to help them with resumes and mentoring and job searches and all the sorts of things that one needs to get established in a new country. So I would really encourage people to look for ways to directly support, and that also creates the kind of bridges that we were talking about when you were asking about children. And then the last way is tzedakah. I think, you know, as you can imagine, this is a very challenging time for organizations that work with refugees and with immigrants. I know Highest, for example, about 3/4 of our budget is either directly or indirectly through the government, either through UNHCR, the UN Higher Commission of Refugees, or literally the State Department. And that is true for many other organizations as well. And I would encourage you, you know, when you think about your tzedakah, to also look, you know, to organizations that are working both domestically in this country with resettlement and internationally. Because as you heard, you know, the vast majority of refugees will never be able to come to America or Canada or Scandinavia. And the last, if I could just, you know, close by saying that I think we're in a historic moment, not just in the sort of dark sense that we've been talking about, and in the way in which our country is threatened around immigration and refugees to be a very dark moment in our nation's history. But we're also, never before have we been in a moment where we, the Jews, haven't been refugees, and instead been in a position to change the future for today's refugees. And I think about this, you know, going back to Purim, I think about this a little bit like our Esther moment, right? Esther says, you know, maybe for this sake was I created. I don't think this is why the Jews were created, but I do think we are at a moment where, you know, even beyond the underlying, you know, all of the foundational Torah that you taught around the ger and about what we cultivate in ourselves in response to the ger, I also think that historically, it's not just that we were Jews, that we were slaves in Egypt, but also we're in a moment now as American Jews who would not be here were it not for America's approach to immigration and refugees, and that we have a very unique role to play. And I know that when we had more than 2,000 rabbis sign on to a statement released 2 days before inauguration saying, we must open our doors to refugees of all ethnic and religious backgrounds, Congress took notice. And they took notice because it was religious leaders, and they took notice because it was Jews. And when we have more than 350 synagogues across the country who have decided to be welcome campaign, highest welcome campaign congregations, it makes a difference. And that we have a responsibility in this moment when we ourselves are not refugees to make a difference for the future of today's refugees.
Thank you. I have to confess, this is one of those times where I have no idea what a wise closing word would be. So I'm going to allow Rabbi Rosen to have the last word, only to say that I think we can all pray for the wisdom, the discernment, and the courage to figure out what the hour demands of us and to rise to the occasion. Thank you so much, Jenny, for being with us. Thank you to all of you.